Well, hello and welcome to Talk About Jazz with Doug Hall. I'm your host, Doug Hall, and our guest today is Laszlo Gardoni, and we do have the pleasure of having a very established jazz pianist who has a long extended career. So I'm going to attempt to summarize just a bit of it, and because it's important to include the credentials of an individual. Hungarian-born American jazz pianist who was a full professor at Berklee College of Music in the piano department since 1987.
Yes.
Graduate, obviously, of Berklee, who also won the Great American Jazz Piano Competition in 1987. And just in 2023 has been invited to join the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences.
Yeah, as a voting member.
And as far as performance is concerned, you have composed 14 albums. Okay. And you're a leader of a jazz trio, and we're going to talk about some of these elements later, but I just wanted to make sure I covered some basic credentials here. You've been playing together with your bassist, John Lockwood, and drummer, is it pronounced Yuron Israel?
Yes.
For approximately 20 years.
Yep.
That's an amazing period of time. And we're going to talk a little bit further about the 22 release, Close Connections, later on in the interview. So welcome, and thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you, everybody, for watching.
Thank you. And so I'm just going to start with your background, harking back to Hungary as a young man. If you could talk a little bit about your musical development as a young man in Hungary before you came to the United States.
Yeah, it's a wonderful subject because it brings me back a lot of memories about my family, you know, my father and mother and grandmother. The first thing that comes to mind from that period is the piano, a nice brown piano, which I understood later came with the furniture.
Okay.
So it wasn't a Stanley or anything. But it gave me a chance to get excited about this wonderful piece of furniture, especially because my father, being a lawyer by education, was an excellent amateur pianist himself.
Okay.
Actually, he had a little black book, which was very similar to what later became a world famous real book that Berklee presented to musicians. So what we have call lead sheets, when you have the melody and the chord symbols. My father had that on jazz standards and some popular songs. He was a multi-instrumentalist, so he played accordion and violin and saxophone. So he never really developed that one focus on one instrument that I did as a pianist. But having a family like that, where my mother loved to sing and my father was a multi-instrumentalist who loved playing, and his friends loved to listen to him, that meant a lot. So that was a great start. And for whatever reason, just because of the influences or just by my genetics or my disposition, I started creating music right away. So I improvised, made things up. I remember my very first opus was realizing that the black key is going to sound beautifully if I just put my fingers on it.
Okay.
Then I wrote a little piece for my grandma, and I started to write some rock music because, of course, I loved rock and roll.
Right.
I started studying classical at the age of 7, but my creative approach was the most important to me. So even sometimes I would show up to a classical lesson and show my teacher, okay, look at what I came up this week. Later it included some classical compositions on my part. A lot of it was rock and roll, you know, obviously. And then I discovered jazz around the age of 18 through friends I heard. And all these influences, like the 3 hours a day improvisational music I would make up after coming home from school, or the classical studies, or my family. It all came together, and I said, I'm home here with this musical genre, and I can learn a lot more here, and I can blossom in this environment. So then I actually went to study mathematics and physics I got accepted to the Science University of Budapest. It's called Eötvös Loránd University. And I met my future wife there. But I always played music, and I always wanted to basically be a musician. So I auditioned to the Béla Bartók Conservatory in my second year of the Science University studies.
Okay.
And I got accepted. And it was very hard to get in there, obviously, needless to say. But it was a great program because it didn't just emphasize classical performance. It actually emphasized a lot more creativity, compositional creativity, and there was a jazz faculty there as well, even though it's a very small scene. Obviously, it was a very small scene in Hungary.
Right.
But they had good resources. So they heard me, they accepted me, and then came the crazy part when I had to be in two places at once and finished up my studies at the Science University while I also went to the conservatory and studied mostly jazz and some classical and African music. And, of course, I got into that small circle of musicians who actually toured internationally, and they were close to the top level of European jazz musicians. So that opened the door to starting to travel in Europe in my early 20s and open for greats like Art Blakey's band or Jack DeJohnette's band and play with some American musicians such as Jack Gregg, the bassist, or Suleiman Hakim, the sax player, who were guests in our band, or even a great Polish sax player I learned a lot from, Zbigniew Namislavski, who used to play with Tomasz Stanko's band. And learned a lot on the road. We would be on the road for a month at a time.
Wow.
And in your early 20s, you can still do that in a in a tour bus, which is not the large tour bus. It's kind of the minivan tour bus. And you learn a lot. And because you love the music, you love improvisation, you respect the people you hear or have the good fortune to open for or play with in some cases. So by the time I got to Berkeley, you know, I had this background. You know?
Amazing. It seems to me such a sophisticated background that you already had under your belt by the time you were 20.
Not 20. I mean, yeah, maybe mid-20s.
Mid-20s. It almost speaks to somebody having a 30 or 40-year-old.
Yes.
I mean, that is quite a an intense full commitment and experience, which is obviously related to your passion for the music, et cetera, but you are enriching yourself with being with all these other professional musicians, being with contemporary musicians, allowing yourself to experiment and to grow and to probably start to compose some music. So as we step off into the next stage of your life, you were going to come to the United States on a scholarship to study at Berklee College of Music in 1983.
That's correct.
And can you talk a little bit about your experience as a student? I mean, coming here, and what were you feeling? What were you experiencing? What was that like?
Well, just very briefly, because I know it's a short interview, it wasn't that easy just to get a scholarship, right?
No.
So there was a lot of back and forth, letters went back and forth between me and Berklee, and they were interested, but it seemed like they want to hear me live to have an audition, which was very hard to do at the time, traveling restrictions, and it was still, you know, behind the Iron Curtain at the time.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of jealousy because it's a small kind of frustrated scene that was there. So as I found out years later, there were some people who really tried to work against this dream of mine.
Right.
And so the only thing I could do is to come here to Boston on my own. I didn't know how long this will take me, how far is this going to take me. And tell Berklee that we have been communicating and I'm here to actually audition and see if I could get a full scholarship because that's the only way I can stay.
Right.
Again, at the time, there was just no way to make the kind of money
certainly
in Hungary, in convertible funds to come here. So they heard me play. I got into the highest classes in theory, ear training, arranging and such because of my experience and I guess my talent. So then they thought about it for a while, and then a couple of days later, they tell me, so, okay. So they gave me the full scholarship and then also a spot in the dorms to be able to live there with several roommates. And there was not much sleep waiting for me, obviously. At least there was a roof over my head and there was, a cafeteria. So that was really generous and wonderful of Berkeley to recognize my talent with that kind of generosity. Yes. And that's how I could stay. And then I finished the school in 2 years. Okay. That was part of, my vow to them that if you give me this full opportunity, which is now considered to be a presidential scholarship, not just a full scholarship, because it includes full accommodations, housing, and cafeteria use, then I will finish that degree in 2 years instead of 4. So I did.
Right. Did you find an important mentor during that period of time, or were you already, in a sense, with enough focus on the direction of music you were interested in?
I think I had a good direction of the music I was interested in.
Right.
But I felt that the entire environment of Berkeley,
the entire department,
was just bringing forth these ideas and crystallizing them so quickly.
Okay.
So the musicians I found, whether the other fellow students like Aaron Scott, who later became McCoy Tyner's drummer for, I think, decades, people like that. And there were a lot of people there, and we inspired each other a lot. And then there were some very influential teachers like Phil Wilson's Big Band Herb Pomeroy, who's also another great one. Right. Yes. So there were some, Bill Pierce, there were some people. And I shouldn't forget maybe one of the most important ones, Donald Brown, the great pianist from Art Blakey's band, who advocated for me so much.
Okay.
He's up to this day, we are keeping in touch and good friends, I'm honored by that,
That's wonderful. I'm wondering kind of in a larger picture, because you have spent 20 years at Berkeley, what would you say is their philosophy, their educational philosophy? I mean, they are considered one of the best music schools in the country in contemporary music. What is it about their philosophy, their educational philosophy, or their standards?
I think Berkeley realized, even from their early experience, where word greats that became word greats later went through the school, sometimes very quickly, but it was never at a closed, only conservatory-like place. But it was a place where personal creativity is nurtured together with a great system of explaining things without any mumbo-jumbo, if you will, or complicated ways of looking at simple things. So there were lots of great practical musicians, and some people criticized them for that at the time. Oh, you're simplifying things. But the truth is that if you had a good instinct, if you're a good musician already, and if you put priority on playing a lot and with the best people you can find, then everything which seemed too pragmatic in the curriculum will actually help. And it just opens up your creativity and take it to another level. So I was very grateful to have that education before I came here, because it made me more mature as a student.
Right.
But without those first couple of months, or especially those continuing relationships musically, what I built there, I wouldn't be anywhere. I would be a much more one-sided player. I couldn't have blossomed into that kind of or teacher, because or as teacher. A teacher, you also have to become open and get a genuine sense of creativity and humility for the tradition at the same time. Not to be an egotistical creative and not to be a stick-in-the-mud traditionalist in a sense that creativity is only in the confines of something that has already been created.
I mean, just as a quick side note, you made me think of something in terms of, I met and interviewed Danilo Perez.
Right.
It was really a mind-blowing experience for me because he is very intense, but yet he's very honest and very direct.
Absolutely. And a good friend.
Wonderful man in so many ways, with particularly what he's doing with the Global Jazz Institute.
I have students from there all the time, yeah.
And I went to what was, I guess, the final recital, and then we had maybe 20 minutes to sit with each mm-hmm. other. And I talked to him and spoke to him. And I asked him about the program and how competitive and demanding it is. There's so many X mm-hmm. number of applicants for this many positions. People are searching to get there. And I said, so you have two musicians of equal talent. They're both highly advanced. They're both mm-hmm. dedicated. So, mm-hmm. so where are we in a decision-making process here? Okay. And he said, well, it actually happens pretty easily because often it's the student that shows the passion yet the desire to share and give. And there's the student where, sadly, it's all about him or her.
Exactly.
And when that student is speaking to me and showing me that, I have to say, I'm sorry, I don't think this is the program for you.
Exactly. It's very interesting. He is, as you mentioned, he is so honest and a good friend. And he told me this story so many times that I got here in 83. I think he got to Berkeley in 85.
Okay.
And there was a little place called the Café Bouquet at the corner of Mass Ave and Havilland Street. Mm-hmm. And there was a little silly jazz program there, and there was no piano, so it was just a keyboard, you know. And people had a good time there. So he comes in as a freshman, and he heard me play there with somebody. I don't even remember who that was.
Okay.
And he turns to his friend and says, oh, the faculty is great here. And then they told him, no, that's a student. And he says, oh, my God, I better start the working on my music. So it's wonderful that he keeps saying it. I just last time he told me this story was like 2 years ago, I think. And it's nice to know that, you know, that moment inspired him. But it also shows how honest he is and how important exactly what you felt from what he said, that if you recognize that the musician is giving, that their purpose right. through their music is to make the world a better place.
Those are his words.
That resonates. It can resonate for decades if you heard something like that. And I played at Berkeley. When I got there, it was a very competitive place. Mm-hmm. I played with people, you know, it was the typical cutting session vibe sometimes.
Right.
And thank God I had the technique and everything, and also still the musical integrity that they never felt that this works here, you know.
Right.
We got to be honest. You can't mess around.
Right.
You can't deface music to compete. And actually, that's how I won the competition as well, the Great American Jazz Piano Competition, that I played music, mm-hmm. played something that the competition itself was in front of 2,000 people. It was a live performance once they selected the five finalists.
Right.
So George Wien, somebody from A&R, Atlantic Records, I think, mm-hmm. Henry Butler, and some other people were on the jury, and they were sitting on the stage as well. But it was in my heart to play for everybody
right.
who was there, that they could go home and feel this mm-hmm. level of spiritedness that music can give you.
Right.
And thank God that the judges were such.
Yes, wow.
That they also heard that and appreciated that. Because that's what won. You know, there was a guy there who just ran around the keyboard as fast as he could, up and
trying
down.
Trying to show off technique.
Like that.
Right.
Yeah. Nobody felt better afterwards when he was finished.
Right. Well, that's so true. And it's interesting. It's something that you learn. I think I learn more when I speak to musicians and speak to people involved in programs that are supposed mm-hmm. to help enrich a student. Granted, at that level, there's a high level of talent and ability there, but still this philosophy seems to be, regardless of that, it's a giving process.
Right.
Okay, if you're here just for yourself, then this program is not going to work for you.
And guess what? I mean, I'm sure you know, that's the same about teaching.
Right.
So if you feel that you're holding back as a teacher, somebody mm-hmm. asks you a question and, oh, I know the answer, but maybe I just keep it to myself.
Right.
Or just give a half answer to a question, not the full story. You shut down some channels in you that provide you also inspiration to be right. a better composer, or at least to feel that there is no expiration date on creativity.
Right.
Because I am the most grateful in my entire life. I mean, besides my family and my health, and that, but as an artist, the most grateful that I remained creative in a way that right. when I write something, it says something and it makes me happy to wow. write it and play it.
Okay.
And see it on the people to love, listen to it. That's just a bonus.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's you know, so many artists, right, who mm-hmm. either burn out or give up or turn commercial
yeah.
or
yes.
they don't appreciate the gift they got and they yeah. just kind of squander it.
That's very well put. Thank you. That is very meaningful to see that coming from someone as you are, as a professional musician, and somebody talking about kind of the heart of what's involved
right.
and feeling that. Jumping channels a little bit and heading kind of more in a direction of possibly the release Close Connections.
Yep.
You have a love for the roots of European folk music and Hungarian folk music.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been written about in the articles I've read about you, and also speaking with Anne Braithwaite. And,
mm-hmm.
So can you talk just a little bit, I know this is a large subject, but a little bit about the historical roots of European folk music and how Hungarian folk music has informed your music and compositions? And then we might move into the
right.
release, Close Connections.
Yeah, so very quickly, it's just that, of course, first you get to know folk music through composers who mm-hmm. applied
right.
folk music, such as Stravinsky, but especially in Hungarian music's case, Kodály, Zoltán Kodály, and Bartók.
Bartók, of course.
Especially
yeah.
Bartók.
Yeah.
And then you read about what they thought of folk music. And they put it very clearly, these composers, that they feel that really great folk music is like a crystallization
okay.
of melodies
okay.
that resonate very deeply
okay.
in a nation. So to be a good uh-huh. melodic,
mm-hmm.
a creator of good melodies, mm-hmm. I should put it that way, that's really relevant to good
okay.
folk music. So as a jazz player or a rock mm-hmm. player or anybody who mm-hmm. creates music, that fundamental way of relating to melodies and to finding them and keeping that channel
mm-hmm.
open where these melodies may come through you.
I
that
see.
Requires humility as well, because
yeah.
we learned so much as an educated musician.
Right.
And I'm not going to name names, but there are people who decide that I write a tune every day. You can't mm-hmm. do that.
Right.
I mean, you know, once they ask Stravinsky, a film director in Hollywood, oh, could you write us a film score? And Stravinsky didn't want to do it.
Right.
Because that's not his way of writing. But he found a good way to say no. He said, yeah, I could deliver it in 3 years.
Right, exactly. If you want something of quality, I can write it to you in 3 years.
And I'm sure it's true that
yeah.
maybe in 3 years, even yeah. it's an awkward project for him,
right.
he would have the humility to almost to being too humble with that person saying that it will take me 3 years. They
yeah.
could look down on him for that.
Right.
But no, it's the truth. You have
yeah.
to wait for that melody. It can happen in 5 minutes. It can happen in a year. And folk music knows that. So
right.
that's the story
yeah.
about folk music.
Now, the other aspect of it that maybe listeners aren't aware of, you were very into you were a big fan of progressive rock
yes.
in England, as I am still.
all
those bands from Yes to King Crimson to Genesis
mm-hmm.
to
right.
Atomic Rooster to
right.
Emerson, Lake and Palmer, amazing musicianship.
Right.
In your 22 release Close Connection, you were mixing a bit of, you were including an interaction between the folk music that you have been influenced by and your love for progressive rock. Mm-hmm. They kind of come together in some way.
Yeah, they came together. I didn't force them together mm-hmm. because that wouldn't be a very humble way to create, right?
So right.
Okay, let's put salt and pepper together and hope it works. But they may have somewhere a similar root in mm-hmm. me, because as a high school student or even as a preteen, I improvised that kind of music the same way as folk music is created. That it was like a diary of my day.
Okay.
To jam on a blues riff or create something in that genre or that kind of genre. And I listen to them the same way that you speak to me. You make it easier for me to survive the teenage years. All of us, right? So in a way, it was very folk music-like in its effect on me and also in the way I replicated that kind of sound. So, of course, it came together with my love of folk music when I went into that direction just without any premeditation for this album. The tunes that came to me this time around, I realized later, that those two influences, which are very deep and profound. You know, one thing I realized that maybe during the COVID years, we got a little closer to our roots as musicians because we had a little more solitude. Mm-hmm. A lot more solitude.
We had a lot more solitude, yes.
So you dug deeper into what you hear and what your roots were.
Yeah.
And I made a lot of improvised pieces during that time in my house. I put it on my YouTube channel. Actually, lgjazz.com is my website. The video link has a lot of these. And they went so deep. Mm-hmm. And went deep in a way that there was no genre restriction. Right, and there was no sense of I'm playing in a jazz club or I'm playing for a recital audience, none of that. So maybe that helped, but generally it was something that was in me very much in the same place, in my musical ear and then in my soul.
Okay,
I mean as folk music and progressive rock.
Right, and so the concept of the album is that evolving as. Well, was it a COVID period? Yes, of course it was.
Yep.
So it's evolving with you and your two partners and musicians, John Lockwood and Yoren Israel. So how are you collaborating?
Well, it's very interesting because Yoren came from a straight-ahead jazz background, mostly. In 1999, when we met, he was pretty much a straight-edge swing drummer on most records I heard. Mm-hmm. Lockwood, John, he always calls himself Lockwood because there are so many Johns. John is a very versatile musician, and he is definitely a revolutionary kind of jazz player. He likes music.
Right.
Like he plays with the Fringe for so many years with George Garzon. So he really wants to hear new sounds. He's not a rocker, but he could understand that this music is progressive and that the time was. So I had to communicate quite a bit about this to them. But we have this long, long history. When he exports so many... I never wrote a composition that rips off another one, by the way. And I have 14 albums, and everyone had something to say. And it's usually not just a musical thing that it wanted to say, but something that I feel in my heart about life. The way I live it or the way I feel, maybe I can be helpful. So they respect that and they understand that instinctively. So if I say something, okay, now we're going to try something that is more relating to progressive rock, they're going to work on it and they're going to find out and we rehearse and we still create in the studio because the music has to be fresh in the studio. You can't go there without expecting that some unexpected beauty is going to happen there. Such as six compositions on this album, which were all collectively improvised.
Okay.
So I wrote six compositions, and six of them were just, I told them, let's play. Let's see what happens, because we are connected on the level that, actually, I didn't make a speech about it. I just said, let's play.
Probably after 28 years or some intuition between all of you.
And it was beautiful. It's again, sort of a prog rock idea. Because a lot of these bands did that. I mean, Deep Purple would improvise on the stage. And then there was a Nirvana before there was a Nirvana. Right. Way back in England, defunct after two albums, I think.
Right.
They were improvising. Soft Machine was improvising. Mm-hmm. So there is so many things that basically come from the fact that we all want to play music that reaches people on a way that that's relevant to them and relevant to us.
Right.
And we all love music as music, right. Not like, oh, I only love straight ahead jazz. I only love progressive rock.
Sure.
I only love folk music.
Wow. Well, that makes sense. And it certainly, when you listen to your release, Close Connections, you can hear the variety from one song to the next.
Yep.
They're very distinctly different.
Mm-hmm.
And the rhythm and the time, the time signatures, all of that. So why don't we move to queuing up and listening to a little bit of two of the compositions that you chose to listen to today. The first one will be Sweet Thoughts. And I guess what you, if you'd like, you could say just a little bit something about it on the front end, and then we can talk a little bit about it afterwards.
Sure. So this was a melody that actually came to me in a dream. I heard sort of a whole band playing this. And so I checked the key. I woke up and went to the piano, checked what key it is in. And then when we rehearsed, I just told them that this is really about this melodic idea, just like folk music.
Okay.
And I have a certain groove in mind, which is a 3-4 waltz, but not the waltzy waltz. Mm-hmm. And we worked on the drum track for a while. I mean, the drum part for a while together during the rehearsal.
Okay.
And finally, when Joran found it, then we had it. Because the rest was that we start with this groove, what I want to hear. And we're going to quote this melody like it keeps coming back to us, like in a dream.
Okay, like about.
And then we depart from it. One of us can improvise, the other one keeps the melody going, or vice versa. But there was not much more planning to it, just using the melody as the reference.
All right. Well, let's have a chance to listen to a little bit of it, and then we can have some thoughts afterwards.
Okay.
So I'm thinking in terms of, I don't have, obviously, a strong self-taught understanding of musical jazz components, but I have listened to a lot of jazz. It seems to me that the word polyrhythmic, is that applicable here, where you're literally, to me, I'm hearing your piano is in its own time, the drummer is a bit in his own time, and then the bassist seems to be in his own time.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing.
Yeah,
about this band, actually, that living in this music together for so many years, and that's the way I want to play. So basically, they understood over the years that there is a center of the groove, center of the rhythm, and we creating our sounds around that groove. So what people experience as groove,
right,
is often the unspoken groove, which is right in the middle, but it moves their own system so much more than if you hammer some. I mean, just think about it. Marching bands, not really inspiring a lot of inner rhythm,
No, because it's being kept for you. Bang, bang, bang. I see,
So it's lovely. And the fact that this music is so open, you know, it gives me a chance to play with the time myself, and these guys don't get scared of that. You know, if I get a new bass player, that's the first thing I say. If John cannot make a concert, please, you understand that we are creating a groove here, which is a combination of these rhythmical concepts and don't think of it that you have to copy what I do. It's always a conversation. Okay. But I know where the groove is. It's right, right there. It's in my head. Right. But I don't have to hammer it like a marching band.
Yeah. And I mean, and the uneducated, such as myself entirely, as far as jazz instruction and components, I hear this sort of tension. I'm finding that groove and saying each of these instruments and each of these artists are creating their own rhythm.
Yeah, and then, of course, it comes together sometimes, of course. And that is also a release. But generally, the one of the most important elements of blues, gospel, and good rock and roll and jazz, certainly, is that it created toe-tapping grooves, right? Or snapping grooves. I mean, you don't snap your fingers to Beethoven.
Right.
There's a lot of amazing quality to Beethoven's music, but you don't snap your fingers to it. And the reason you snap your fingers to this kind of music is because they all, to some degree, do what you described in this one.
Yes.
That the center of the groove is left for the audience and for you to feel. We also feel it, but we want to communicate that. Right. It's almost like a generous space left for you to feel the groove as a listener.
Well, I think this was a very good selection so we could have that conversation, because I think that a lot of listeners often are wondering now, it feels a little bit, the musicians are playing around something, but yet I'm kind of feeling that movement is coming back to me, and that's happening.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just part of, it's so intuitive to your playing because of your talent and ability and the years of playing together.
Mm-hmm. I do this in solo as well.
Yeah.
So it's actually, I mean, in solo piano, what I mean.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you can do this against your own left hand,
your own
with
left
your
hand.
Right hand.
Right. Yeah. Now, why don't we move to the next song, Cedar Tree Dance. And that has this, what I think is just this lovely, I wrote down some notes, of melody that's uplifting and soaring without being more descriptive than the mood that it lifts you in.
No, thank you.
And I'm sorry, I should have asked you to give the introduction.
No, that's perfect. Let's listen to it.
So, all right. What a soaring piece. I've really enjoyed having a chance to talk to you in depth about your background, which is astounding to me, what you were involved in musically already in Hungary as a young man, and your opportunity to be here. And I'm sure there's a lot of students who are very fortunate. And I look forward to listening to a performance with your trio, and keeping an eye on your next release.
Thanks.
And I'm sure that there's many projects that you have in front of you and that you're involved in.
It's certainly true. We locally, we're going to play at Scholars with a quartet, actually.
Okay.
My trio plus Don Braden on sax, and that's November 16th. We just played at Birdland in New York, and lots of other ones are coming. coming up. Okay. And as I said, my website is lgjazz.com. Very easy to find. L for Laszlo, G for Gardoni, Jazz for the music I play.
Right. Well, again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And it's been a pleasure to share with you. And also, I always learn so much when I'm speaking with jazz musicians.
I always learn so
accomplished
much
as you are. Thank you.
People such as yourself.
Thank you very much.